Welcome, members and guests, to the June 13th program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome to our broadcast audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. Today we're presenting the annual Turtle Awards and learning about an all-wooden railroad built in our region nearly a century ago. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President for 2014 and 15. Thank you to KLCC Radio for airing our programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the broadcasts on their website. Our sponsors today are Network Charter School, Helios Resource Network, and KRVM Radio. A special thank you to KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. A quick reminder that these programs are free for our listening audience, but it does cost money to produce them, and lots of volunteer effort. Your contributions are most welcome and completely tax deductible. And now for the first half of our program. Here to introduce this year's Turtle Awards is Jean Tate, 1994 Turtle Award recipient. She's also a great grandmother of nine, former president of the Metropolitan Affordable Housing, now Cornerstone Community Housing, and developer of the Tate. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you very much. I'm sure all of you know that the Turtle Award is for someone who wants to stick their neck out. And as someone who has done that and been swatted down a few times, I can tell you it's not always fun, but the results are always well worth it. And we are gathered together to award this year's Turtle Award to two very special people. I would first like to introduce Beth Giroux, who will present the first turtle.
Thank you very much, Jean. Grace Boggs, a philosopher, author, and influential civil rights and black power activist in Detroit, once said, "Changing is more honorable than not changing." This is a powerful statement about what it means to be a change leader. Change involves letting go of some of what you know and are comfortable with in the best interest of the whole. It often takes having the courage to stimulate action in the face of opposition, even that of friends and colleagues, and to develop allies so that creative solutions can emerge. Craig Smith, the winner of this year's City Club Turtle Awards, is just such an honorable change leader. When I first met Craig, I put him into the serious lawyer category, but quickly came to appreciate who he was on a much deeper level. What I found was his unwavering commitment to make our schools and our community a better place to live, and the courage to stick his neck out to stimulate action. I experienced his uncanny ability to see an issue, run it through the filter of fact, past experience, and what is right, and effectively bring about change. He continues to do this, not by grandstanding, but by persistence and constantly seeking common ground. I've had the incredible opportunity to work with Craig on the Eugene School Board for the last 15 years. During that time, the district has experienced the devastating impact of the passage of Measure 5. Craig has been steadfast in stimulating support for increased school funding. He has lobbied legislators at the federal, state, and local level, constantly reminding them of the connection between a good public education system and the well-being of a community. As a respected leader, he has moved the conversation to one in our local legislative delegation, where our local legislative delegation looks to 4J school board members for guidance in crafting legislation, rather than viewing them as special interest lobbyists. Craig is always among the first to volunteer to fundraise and canvass in support of both our local option levy and capital campaigns. At nearly every board meeting this year and on numerous other occasions, he has stressed the need to support the local option renewal, which will be on the ballot in November, and without which the Eugene School District would need to cut an additional $8 million. In his support for bond measures, Craig eloquently speaks to the need to upgrade our aging facilities in order for the school district to be able to meet the needs of all of our students, both today and into the future. and he continually emphasizes that these students belong to all of us. Craig's outreach has also extended to leadership roles in the Eugene Chamber of Commerce, the Eugene Rotary Club, Networking for Youth, and the Eugene City Club Program Committee. In each of these, he has found ways to push the need for solid support for and understanding of our broader community of the needs of our public schools. He knows that our students must graduate college and career ready, and that this requires a community effort. One of the most difficult decisions a school board member can make is to close schools and/or consolidate programs, even when it will ultimately be in the best interest of students. During the time that Craig has been on the 4J board, he has been a part of 11 such events. In each case, he has stuck his neck out to clearly and consistently articulate the reasons for those decisions, even in the face of opposition, while always showing respect for impacted families. As he often acknowledges, it is adults rather than the children who generally have the most difficult time letting go of what is known and embracing change for the greater good. I view Craig as a moderate conservative, but he sometimes sticks his neck out in surprising ways. I don't know how many of you know that Craig, together with his brother and nephew, got tattoos while in Key West, Florida. Or that he feigned to lure this brand new school board member into a questionable venue for dinner while at a national school boards conference. Or that at one point he was misperceived to be advocating for the use of pesticides in our schools when he said that kids were more important than bugs and was challenged in the next election for this. On a personal note, with all that we have shared over the years, I am honored to call Craig a good friend and colleague. His willingness to stick his neck out and to quietly take on important leadership role in our community to bring people together and stimulate constructive action makes him very deserving of this Turtle Award. Thank you, Craig, for all that you do.
Thanks. Can I go up here and sit? Why? Listening to Beth makes me wonder who she's really talking about, but I guess it was me. And while I thank the City Club certainly for this award, I view it more as an acknowledgement of the value that the City Club and the community at large places on public education, and particularly as it's provided in 4J. And it's not me, it's really, I think, our district. As I attended the Sheldon High School graduation last night, I reflected on the academic, artistic, and athletic achievements that were recited by the students. And I felt an appreciation for their achievements both in my heart and in my brain. In my brain, I reflected on how important it is for us to provide an education for our children and prepare them for a future as citizens in a democracy and prepare them also for their economic future and their artistic future. In my heart, I was struck by the comments from the vice president of the student body, who was a student who was born in Korea, moved with his family to China near Afghanistan, was educated there for a while, and then moved in his freshman year to Sheldon, and was welcomed to that educational community as a peer, embraced, recognized for his academic achievement, as well as leadership skills. And as I reflected on that, I said, those kids are really modeling great behavior. It's behavior that perhaps we adults in this community should keep in mind, as on occasion, we have divergent, strongly held views. But we should always be looking for that common ground because most of us in this community are here for a reason, where the reason is that we share common values. That kid was just an amazing student. Get stuck together, I'll get it here. When you get old, you just forget a lot of stuff. I was reminiscing when Beth was talking about the years I've known her on the school board, which has been 13 of my 19 years, I could fill in some of the blanks, but I won't do it in public because it embarrassed both of us. But I wanted to just kind of reflect on my service for the last 19 years, and I have one more year to go and will not run again if anybody's interested in that. And it all started actually in 1995 at a Rotary meeting when I was there with Mike Fox and Phil Barnhart, who were both then serving on the school board. And they came up to me and said, "Craig, I understand you're interested in running for the school board." And I said, "Yeah, someday, but not now." And they said, "Well, the filing deadline's in a couple of days. Make a decision." So I decided to run. And, which was shocking, is I was not opposed. Subsequently, I was opposed on two of my five elections. And one which Beth alluded to, which is when I was on a committee with Mary O'Brien. Some of you may recall her. And it was an oversight committee that was part of a group that was trying to lessen the friction within the community and have more civil conversations. And Mary mentioned in passing that, I said I appreciated this community because it supports kids so much. And she said, "Well, you know, not all folks in this community share that value. In some aspects value animals and even plants as equally." And I said, "Well, that's interesting." So at a school board meeting subsequently, we were talking about selecting people for a committee. And I said, "Well, there are these folks that have been described as not necessarily sharing our values, so I think we should reach out and see if they'd like to participate in our committee." And somehow that upset a segment of this community who put forth a candidate to run against me because I believed in toxics in schools, I guess. It was just an interesting vignette. Another thing, as I reflected on service, are those difficult times when you do stick your neck out on close votes. And the tradition for our board is that the board chair makes the final vote when we have a public vote. So you don't know how the chair is going to vote till the end. And I had two close votes like that. I was board chair twice for a total of 4 years. One had to do with condoms in the schools. And this was when I was first time I was around as a board chair. And the issue was whether school nurses in high schools could prescribe condoms to kids who had diagnosed sexually transmitted diseases, who indicated a pattern of behavior where they're going to participate in spreading that disease. And it was a 4-3 vote, and I voted in favor of that. I might add that Mike and Phil voted against that. Not that I remember that vividly, but I do. And I remind them of that occasionally. The second one was what I would describe as Civic Stadium 1, which was the vote where we decided not to accept any of the RFPs. It was 2011, wasn't it? Time goes by. And again, that was one where that one was a hard decision. The first one for me was not a hard decision, but that one was a hard one. And obviously in both situations, there were people who disagreed with me. Finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't elaborate a little bit on what Beth was saying about finances, school finances. That one of the things that's kind of interesting to reflect is the number of people who are voting now who don't really know what Measure 5 was. That's part of their culture, part of their expectations. And I think it's important to just remind people that we made a decision through initiative in the early 90s to change funding from local to the state. And therefore change a lot of rulemaking to the state. As you know, the only way we can raise money now, as Beth said, is through bonds for capital items and local option for operations. And what we discovered over the last few years is the local option is not as volatile, but volatile source of revenue as well as the income tax, which the state suffers from. The district has gone from about $14 million to about $8 million in that revenue stream. And one thing that you might be interested in doing is looking at your property tax statements over the last 5 years or so, and you may find that your local option, which was there 5 years ago, is gone or substantially reduced. I know in ours, we haven't had a local option tax assessment in probably, 3 years or 4 years. So what we've done is increased our funding to the Eugene Education Foundation. And as Beth said, again, I just want to remind you that in November of this year, the local option election is again coming on the ballot. And the $8 million is 80 teachers. Think about that. Thank you.
I'm remembering that John told me I should tell you the history of the turtle. We traveled to Taos and Santa Fe, and I found a turtle very much like this one. And my husband really liked it, so I bought it for him as a present. Shortly thereafter, I was at a City Club meeting where we were deciding how we should present what we could present to somebody. And so I stole the turtle, the first turtle, from Wayne, and we had John Van Nunningham's name carved on it. So that's the history of the turtle. The next honoree, Lauren Reagan, is going to be introduced by Jean Stacy.
Thank you. First, I want to congratulate the City Club for having the foresight to, in fact, define a turtle award for those who are willing to stick their neck out. I think the times in our country, in part, have been set by many of us being a little tied into our little shells of work and family and hobbies and, more recently, computers and enhanced telephones. And we frequently aren't even aware of what's going on in our community, much less in a position to stick our necks out and take a little risk. Lauren is the opposite, and we're very fortunate that she is. I think she has recognized as a very young child that she wanted very much to defend others, and she began with protecting animals as she had the early onset to realize that eating them was really not in their best interest and became a vegetarian. She's been working very hard, and I am very grateful for that, not only on the local level, but also on the national level, because the issues are so severe with the mega corporations and the misconduct of government that we can't just work at home. She's most recently been very involved on the National Steering Committee for the Global Climate Convergence, which is bringing together all the millions, literally, of activists around the country from labor unions, animal rights, human rights, indigenous rights, environmental rights. And instead of all of us just pitching our little battles, for all of us to realize we are fighting and facing up against the same common 0.1% of the folks who are kind of running the world without much consideration for the rest of us. And this is a very powerful group of people, and Eugene is going to be a critical part of that. She's also been working with climate justice, and what I like about what Lauren does is she not only does her own work, but there's a huge ripple effect with all the training that she has been doing nationwide. More recently, 200 lawyers were trained by her to defend activists and to do it on a pro bono basis. She is constantly attending national conferences, working on First Amendment issues, teaching others how to protect those very important constitutional rights, working on privacy and surveillance, which we are all aware are things that are very much at risk, and also empowering marginalized populations to speak out for themselves, not just to be spoken out for. And she's worked heavily with indigenous people, immigrants, those who are homeless. She has done enormous trainings, as I spoke of earlier, both nationally and locally, and some of the most important are Know Your Rights training for activists, for indigenous group, immigrants, homeless. An activist can't go out there without being very well aware of their rights as protesters, and otherwise we can run into a lot of trouble. She also has trained legal observers to go and be expert witnesses. They're certified by the National Lawyers Guild, and therefore their evidence has a lot of credibility in court when it becomes a he said, she said between the police and a protester. Even locally, Lauren's work has had national impact, recently suing or litigating against the federal government in conflict with their curfews and permits. evicting processes, which stopped Occupy from being able to use the plaza as a protest site. She has progressed that sufficiently in the court that the Sleeps protest have been there for over 7 months without interruption until they finally declared a victory and left. She's also had litigation on the county at the same level. Her training has a huge ripple effect, and her own leadership has been very important. I first met Lauren myself as a 66-year-old who had never done anything more outrageous than write a letter to my congressman to protest something that I was unhappy with. And when Occupy came, I went to one of the pre-meetings and met Lauren. I was just totally inspired by her conviction and her lack of fear. I had been wandering around for years, disturbed, but impotent to do anything about it. One of the first things she did was organize occupation education, which is bringing in experts in all the areas of protesting, the misconduct of government. And from those things that I learned there, we were able to put together the Sleeps movement, which most of you are familiar with, which has made great inroads here in the community. I knew when I was standing on a corner, kind of shaking, wondering what in the world my Country Club Junior League mother and my former Fortune 500 clients would think of me waving this placard wildly, hoping for a honk or two to encourage me, when Lauren marched up to me, and we didn't know each other then, and she handed me a list and said, "Here, we're going to go march against the banks, and I want you to read out this one, because it's really all, you know, it's the nasty list of what this bank has been doing." And I looked down and I read the list and I thought, well, this is horrible. I will be happy to read it, Lauren. And I got down to the final line, and it was Bank of America. My daughter at the time was a lawyer in the corporate headquarters of the Bank of America in Charlotte. So I quickly had to confront my old life and my new life in this one very dramatic moment. Lauren, even now, is thinking far into the future. She has a very innovative new project this summer. It's called the Next Generation Climate Justice Activist Camp, I think. Action Camp, and is used to train young people, so many of whom are adrift today, not understanding what the future might hold. And so she is going to be able to train them so that they can begin at a young age to affect change in our country and in our community instead of waiting until they're 66, as I did. I personally am enormously grateful for Lauren, too, who has helped me and many others in our community lose our sense of impotence and feel more empowered and have more satisfaction in the roles we're playing in our own lives. I am particularly grateful because she'll be defending me soon in municipal court on criminal trespass when we tried to prevent the city manager from shutting down Whoville when it could have been peacefully moved a few weeks later to a new site. So I'd like to introduce Lauren now and thank her for all that she has done for our community and nation.
Well, thank you very much. This is quite an honor. And I wanted to kind of start off with a little bit of a quote from Malcolm X. And he said, "You don't have to be a man to fight for freedom. All you have to be is an intelligent human being." And, you know, as Jean kind of alluded, a lot of the organizing and activism and work that I do lately especially is toward building a mass movement, building a movement that will have the power to actually effect some of the systemic changes that need to happen. I always think one of the biggest faults of the environmental movement was taking on the issue of climate change, because, of course, climate change involves jobs, it involves corporation, it involves where we're getting our energy. You know, it's so much more than just an environmental issue. And so, as she mentioned, part of what I do is try to bring together different social change movements that have things in common. And, one of the things that I learn as I get older is, what unites us is actually much stronger than what divides us. And, solidarity is a word that holds a lot of importance, particularly in social justice struggles. And I decided a long time ago that I was going to be a lawyer and that I was going to use my brain to help create the world that I wanted to live in. And that was a world that was based in compassion for all living things, whether it be animals or homeless people or Native Americans being run off their land. There is a commonality and a nexus of just trying to do something, anything to reduce the amount of suffering of the living things around me. And so, the Civil Liberties Defense Center, which is the organization that I founded 10 years ago, we've defended over 900 activists now for free in that time period. We've had dozens of police and government misconduct lawsuits that have been filed to really enforce the rights of everyone, to ensure that someone else's son or daughter or husband or wife will not be left to die in a jail cell while suffering from psychosis. That someone holding a video camera and observing the police will not be beaten and arrested for exercising First Amendment rights in a public place. All of the cases that we try to bring, I am looking down the road and trying to think, how will this affect my community and how will it make things better for people? And so I take my role as a leader in my community very seriously. And with that, that means recognizing that you must replicate yourself, that you must surround yourself with good people, that you must work beyond just what you can do yourself. Really this should be a little herd of turtles, because I think, in order to really be effective and to keep yourself safe, particularly in times of repression, you must keep good people around you at all times. And I think, whether that is a dozen or a million, I think that that is really important. And to recognize that no person really can win anything alone. And so I'm extremely thankful to the people that I work with, to the clients, to the organizers that I've met through doing this work all over the country, to my friends and people that do give me support so that I can do this work every single day. And I feel very proud to be able to go to sleep at night every day knowing that I did something that day that benefited my community and that I'm proud, of the efforts that I've made. And I wake up every morning, sometimes tired because I work long hours, but I'm excited to get to work to see, what will come through the door and what I will work on in that given day. I think one of the most important ways that we can all share the talents and the abilities that we are lucky to have is by, doing things like Know Your Rights trainings or information workshops within our community to empower other people to become better activists and organizers so that they can help their communities to be more strategic and effective in whatever struggle, whatever issue they may be campaigning for. And so, oftentimes my last name is pronounced incorrectly. It's actually Regan instead of Reagan, like President Reagan. But today I actually found a quote from President Ronald Reagan that I thought was pretty apropos in where I currently am thinking about our own community. And that is, when you can't make them see the light, make them feel the heat. And so if they can't wrap their heads around what's going on right now in our community, then we will make them feel the heat soon. So again, thank you very much. And I really appreciate the sentiment and thoughts behind this award.
Thank you so much, Lauren Regan and Craig Smith, for your service to this community. The second half of our program today features C. David Haskell and a fascinating look at Oregon history. A man of eclectic interests and achievements, Haskell began his professional life as a high school teacher and retired recently from a 40-year nursing career. He serves on the board of the Saturday Market and runs his own writing business. Please join me in welcoming C. David Haskell.
Marlene, if you would come back up just for a second. On behalf of the team that put the railroad book together, which include my friend and partner and editor, Jeff Moses, and Earl Kelly, who did some early work on the railroad in the 1990s, I'd like to present to the City Club a spike from the Horton Railroad.
Oh, fun. Oh, great. Thank you. That's fabulous. Thank you.
Okay, buckle your seatbelts. Tell me the story again, I say, sitting on my grandpa's knee, of the tracks built of Oregon tree, of the land and mountains tall, and the wooden railroad that made the call. All right, with false reluctance and a smile, my grandpa begins again the tale of 16 Mile. Suddenly, the tracks appear. Oh, thank you, gentle families here. A window open just for me, the railroad built of Oregon tree. The story of the AJC&H Railway, the Horton Railroad, is not a story of failure, but it is a story of defeat. But are we not inspired by those chances we take, those setbacks, those times we stick our neck out again and again until we get it right? Perhaps inside of each of us is a restless pursuit of perfection. Those without a past will stumble in the dark in the present and enter the future in the dark and continue to stumble. William T. Volman, one of the most important writers in the United States today. Stories, it seems, are how we anchor ourselves in times of trouble. It helps define who we are and where we're going and where we've been. But today we're going to hear a story about a wooden railroad that was built just north and west of Eugene, in the Coast Range, in that difficult terrain. But a story has a little bit of history and a little bit of fiction. There's no doubt fiction makes a better job of the truth. Doris Lessing, Nobel Prize winner, 1949. It is the 1920s. It is the best of times, in some places at least, perhaps not in agricultural-based Lane County. The economy is roaring around us. We are descendants of storytellers. Here, those pioneers before us, we are inspired by their accomplishments in the previous century, like the crossing of the prairie in a covered wagon, a perilous six-month journey, and by the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. The journey now takes 6 days. It is the internet of the 19th century. Trains are big and powerful and fast, and our state is crisscrossed with a number of small railroads. The railroads are the way you get things done. In the 1920s, we carved our story in the granite rocks of Mount Rushmore. Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and who's number four? Theodore Roosevelt. He assumed the presidency in 1901. He inherited a country on the ropes, following the death by assassination of yet another president, William McKinley, in 1901. He is wildly popular, having lost both his wife and mother in the same day. He assumes a country deep in debt and on the ropes. Distrust in government is high. And he sticks his neck out with phrases like this: "No one cares how much you know until they know how much you care." He means it. In 1909, he will sponsor the first White House conference on dependent children and dependent mothers, and the country takes notice. He will be the youngest president to ever assume the office. He will set Crater Lake aside as a national park and many forests as reserves. He will be the first president to fly an airplane, and the country is enthralled. He becomes an agent for change, and the social seeds of change planted decades before begin to sprout. A woman will go to Congress for the first time, the Honorable Jeanette Rankin of Montana, 1916. Women get the right to vote in Oregon, 1912. In 1920, the 19th Amendment is passed. Women now can vote in national elections, but they are not content. The Equal Rights Amendment will be presented to Congress for the first time in history, 1923. Things are happening. We become a country of compromise. The seeds of suffrage have sprouted, and we are on a roll. The automobile and airplane come into their own. Henry Ford will reduce the workday to 8 hours and shock the industrial world. Unions thought it was great. We told our story in our deeds. Lindbergh will fly the Atlantic, 1927. Women will compete in the Olympic Games for the first time in history, 1928. The most popular poster of the 1920s is a woman in a business suit. Do I want to be wife and mother? Do I want to stay in the world of work? They have supported the war effort to help defeat the Axis powers. The Big Bang Theory is conceived. We are a nation of thinkers. Social and intellectual values collide in a courtroom in Tennessee with the Scopes monkey trial. But in isolated Horton, Oregon, 18 miles west in the Coast Range, by radio hooked to a car battery, they may have heard about the world around, or perhaps it was in the newspaper or a letter in the mail. We are separated by 18 miles of unreliable roads, the Mapleton Junction City Highway. We are farmers and ranchers, but we sit in the middle of 2 to 4 billion boards feet of the most incredible old growth straight game timber in the world. But we have no way to get it out. Old Isaiah Slater kept the store and Alice kept the mail. Charlie drove the freight wagon through wind and rain and hail. Jeff Campbell drove the stage hack and brought the mail from town, with now and then a passenger who came to look around. Local historian Ruth Adams, The History of the Lake Creek Valley. It is 1923, and inventor Arthur Arnold receives a patent in Portland, Oregon, for an unusual locomotive design. Familiar with logging on plank roads, he decides to turn the boards on edge to make rails for his locomotive. His locomotive is lightweight, has rubber tires, and can travel up to 18 miles an hour loaded in either direction. It utilizes a 50-horsepower Packard engine. It has 17 forward gears and brakes on every wheel. It can turn a corner with a 100-foot radius. Pulling two cars, it can handle 10,000 feet of lumber per trip. It can climb a 27% grade. It is perfect for the steep terrain of the Oregon Coast Range. It is 1925, and Arnold is hard at work. Lumber prices are low. Much of the available timber has been cut away at lower elevations in the Willamette Valley to make room for more crops. Demand for lumber is growing. Isolated by seasonal road, Horton is still without a low-cost way to bring the huge logs to market. Despite the steep terrain, the Lake Creek Valley is farming country. It is a time of large families and strong family bonds. It is a time for living off the land and trusting your neighbor. Handshakes rule instead of paper, but there is a mistrust of outsiders. If Arnold's idea is going to work here, the people of the Lake Creek Valley must learn to accept both, pool their resources, and agree to build the railroad. Much of the right-of-way is privately owned, and pressure builds for everyone to participate, their money and or their land. What is good for one is good for all. Pioneer families will once again form a wagon train, this time going east with rubber tires. Ranchers in the Lake Creek Valley now see a viable route to bring their crops to the Willamette Valley, and a community consensus means the project can move forward. By 1926, approval by Lane County, and with Arnold's support and salesmanship, a 90-day construction schedule is developed to build the 18-mile railroad. The line will be built of wood, and it'll be built with money as it comes in, following the model set down by the Milwaukee Road Railroad that goes across the middle of Montana. A total of $180,000 is raised. Workers are hired, and using only hand tools, they begin work. The builders are unwilling to wait for Arnold's locomotive and come up with their own design. Logging as they go, falling timber on the grade to pack it down, they wait for Arnold to perfect his design. They build from the east and the west, following the model of the Transcontinental Railroad. The builders decide to attack the most difficult parts first, crossing the high ravines with trestles as high as 70 feet. Why do the easy part first? The 90-day construction period passes to the first of many weather-related delays. Laying the rails directly on the wet ground leads to regular breaks in the track. With only hand tools, repairs take time, but Arnold promises more money. With an inexhaustible supply of timber, repair rails are cut from each returning load of logs to the Horton Mill, and the project moves forward. The tracks work well for hauling logs down to the mill and finished lumber back up to the grade. The idea looks solid. It is a race to High Pass Summit. And the children of the workers march off to school, riding in the back of a wagon covered only by a tarp and spinning their jump ropes at recess, saying, "They use it up because the tracks wear out. They use it up because the tracks wear out." The first of many derailments occur, and anger against Arnold grows. His locomotive has still not arrived, and his visits to the work sites are fewer. The builders solve their problem by tripling the width of the rails. The building of a new railroad is good business in the Willamette Valley. And the children now sing as they spin their jump ropes. They use it up because the tracks wear out. The rails will have to do, or Horton's in the stew. They build on. It is 1928. 60% of the line is now completed. The line still sags and wobbles without rock ballast for support. The crews are afraid and now get off the train on the taller trestles, put it in gear, send it across, run to the bottom of the ravine, up the other side, and catch the train to ride to town. Without Arnold, the decision is made to elevate more of the rails on trestles to hold a steady grade, again using the Milwaukee Road in Montana as a model. Now progress slows to a near halt. They need 18 miles, and they've completed 14. Expenses rise, and the remaining money begins to run low. Oregon is in a 5-year drought. Fires are burning up and down the Pacific coast. Men are conscripted to battle ablaze. There are signs of yet another depression. It will arrive here before other parts of the country. The resolve of the builders is to stick their necks out further and go it alone without Arnold or his locomotive. They changed the design of the home-built engine again, following a brake failure and derailment that injures several men. The children now sing, as children often do in simplest terms, "The engine better come, because we're looking pretty dumb." Arnold cannot be found, but the custom-made locomotive is finally scheduled to arrive. It will not arrive until 1929, too late to save the railroad. And now the children sing, "Arnold better show, because we've spent up all our dough." Or, "If Arnold can't be found, we're not Willamette bound." 1929 proves to be a disaster. It is the worst of times. Although the custom-built locomotive works well and 16 miles of track are now usable, the Horton Mill burns for a second time. There is no money to rebuild. The log unloading station and log pond are ready at Bear Creek, just 2 miles of flat grade away. They will never be used. Steel rails are needed to bond with Southern Pacific, and there is no money available. Cash-strapped Southern Pacific Railroad is waiting, but has its own problems. They are embroiled in a property dispute with Lee Cheshire, the town's namesake, just a few miles south of the log unloading station. Cheshire has gated their tracks. Each train must now stop, open the gate to pass. Discouraged, the crews begin to abandon the Horton Railroad work sites, but are hopeful to return. They leave their tools behind along the grade. One eyewitness reported that it was as if they left for lunch and never came back. Now the children sing the whole story. Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. During the winter of 29 and 30, the valley floor floods yet again, and the depression follows, as does the ridicule. Anyone related to the project refuses to talk about the railroad, and the line is quickly forgotten. Landowners who invested begin tearing up the tracks from both ends. They will build barns and fences to try to get something back. Several are still visible along Smith Road on the east end of the grade and the west end at Horton. 10 years later, lumber is our primary export, more than any other state. The Horton Mill will be rebuilt by the Hult family. By the mid-30s, Highway 36 is improved, and the timber can now be brought to the mills in the Willamette Valley, this time by log truck. There's plenty of crushed rock to support the highway. It is still being brought out today. So sometimes when we stick our necks out, we are ahead of our time. We are the messengers to the future, nourishing the seeds of others, preparing the way for the success to follow. I think if the line were operating today, however, it would be hauling vacationers along a wild ride up to the many wineries that now dot High Pass Road. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. We have just a few minutes to break and in our tables and have a little discussion and have a few questions to ask of David. So we'll want to break for just a second.
You're listening to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, at 88.1, KLBR Bend, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and on the web, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the City Club program for the annual Turtle Awards and some Oregon history on June 13th, 2014. And we have time for just a few questions, and so we'll start that now. Thank you.
Hi, Lance Caronto, City Club member. I was wondering, what is left of the right-of-way? Is there anything visible, or was it used for something else later?
Feel free to check the easel out front. You'll see the Google Earth view. You can see a faint outline of the grade along High Pass Road. The difficulty is the area's been logged at least once, and I'm a little uncertain sometimes when I look at Google Earth if I'm looking at the grade or a skid road that they use during the logging. But when I find the nails with my metal detector, I know I'm back on the grade. And so you can see the nails out front in the display and a simulation of what I think the laminated 3 2x8s would have looked like. And at that time, of course, the 2x8 was a real 2 inches, so you had quite a block of wood that would have been one of the rails. And because they were laminated, they could go around corners and do things easily. But in terms of the grade, since they had no rock, you know, it was all made with hand tools. There is some evidence they brought a steam shovel up right at the very end because they had a big, steep cut bank, but I couldn't find any evidence of it up there. So, again, it's been the area's been used, and it's difficult to find the grade, actually. You'll see a picture out there of what it looks like when you're looking for it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good question.
Susan Connolly, City Club member. Thank you so much. That was a wonderful story. My question is similar to the last person. I was just wondering, you know, all over the world they've taken railroad beds and done wonderful hiking trails, bicycling trails. Is there any way this could be done, or is the grade just too steep?
Well, it's difficult, again, to find the grade. What I would love to have is one of those history here plaques that goes at either end and said, it was here, you don't see much now. But again, if you have a metal detector, you can find your way along, but they had no rock. And, you know, ironically, if you go out there now, there's a big rock quarry almost on Smith Road. So had they had the resources to crush the rock and buy steel, it would still be there, I think. You'd be able to put a bike, you know, route or something on it. That'd be a great trip.
Ruth Demler, I have several questions. One is, going by train from here to Portland, because of the freight, we often spend 3 or 4 hours going to Portland. And I was wondering, are we ever going to have a separate line for freight so we can have a fast ride that we keep dreaming of?
I have to admit I'm really anxious for the high-speed rail. I've traveled extensively in Europe and Asia, and infrastructure is remarkable there. The trains run every few minutes. They're on time, and they're big, and they're fast, and they're powerful, and people rely on them as their main transportation hub. I'd love to see us move in that direction, at least as an alternate to auto transportation.
Another thing is that a lot of seniors are living on the coast now. I understand Florence is 65% senior population. And a lot of us are seniors here, and we'd love to have a ride to the coast, and I think they'd like to have a ride to Eugene. Is there any possibility ever of going on a train to the coast from nearby?
Well, you know, when they rebuilt that track between here and Coos Bay, they did allow a few people on very early, but I don't think there's any plan to make that a transportation route for people. And interestingly, just yesterday I heard on the news, because they were talking about the Empire Builder, one of the oldest trains in the U.S. that's still in use, and it's way behind schedule and it's kind of out of date. But the idea was that, you know, that was a golden age, that form of transportation.
And it'd be nice to have it back. Is there another route then that could be taken if we can't use what we have now?
That's a good question to think about that. Thank you.
David, I'm going to ask a question of one of our turtles, Craig. A kid said to me, a new grad, what's the use? You can't make a difference. You know, corporations are people. Life is falling apart. what's anybody to do? So I guess what I'd like to hear from you is, what is an answer in a minute or two that we've got? What are the things that you feel that your individual effort on a team of people who cared, what are the things you're proudest of having been able to accomplish because you set your mind to accomplish that as a board member?
I think that probably the primary thing is getting the board to work as a team. I mean, when you have individually elected officials, you come with pretty independent thinking people. And to try to get them to coalesce and go the same direction is a challenge. The experience I've had on the board has been great in the 19 years I've been on, because we share a value of public education, and that kind of overcomes most issues. But still there are those rough edges, and I think trying to get the group going the same direction is the primary accomplishment.
Thank you for bringing clarity and vision to this week's City Club program. We've honored the 2014 Turtle Award winners, Lauren Regan and Craig Smith, and we've heard from C. David Haskell about Oregon's All-Wooden Railroad. A final thanks to our sponsors, Network Charter School, Helios Resource Network, and KRVM. And a reminder about next Friday, June 20th, when we gather at the Downtown Athletic Club again for a program titled Meeting the Medical Needs of Lane County's Newly Insured. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you again for joining the City Club of Eugene.